Let me welcome everyone to the LSE and to the annual Founders Day lecture. This event, now in its eighth year, has become one of the features of LSE life. Tonight's occasion, however, is special. Such is the popularity of the guest speaker that this theatre is, or will shortly be, completely full, and we've had to spill over into the old theatre, where no doubt there is a capacity audience as well. We are very honoured to have with us the Italian Prime Minister, Professor Romano Prodi. And we are proud to say that Professor Prodi is both an alumnus of the school and an honorary fellow, and if you'll notice, wearing his LSE badge. The centre-left coalition, led by Professor Prodi, emerged as the winner of the 13th Italian general election of the post-war period in April 1996. The LSE coalition comprises not only the PDS, but also the Italian Popular Party, the Italian Renewal Movement, and the Greens. Opinion polls at the time indicated that this would be a close result, and such was indeed the case. Professor Prodi, in fact, was originally due to deliver this lecture on October the 6th. At that moment, disaster threatened, and he had to cancel his visit and remain in Rome to negotiate his budget. We had to cancel at a very late date, but he was very kind in giving me a sympathetic telephone call. Professor Prodi and his government and the LSE fortunately survived to regroup and reschedule. Everyone who supports a progressive point of view, not only in Italy but in Europe as a whole, must surely be happy about this outcome. One of the high points of his administration so far has been, as a result of all this, to prepare the conditions for Italy's entry to the EMU. Outside of politics, Romano Prodi is Professor of Economics and Industrial Policy at the University of Bologna and has carried out extensive research on the Italian industrial economy. He is the author of numerous publications on European industrial policies, public enterprises in Italy, energy and the working of different economic systems. He was chairman of IRI, the Institute of Industrial Reconstruction, from 1982 to 1989, and again from 1993 to 1994. He's also been a member of the boards of several international industrial companies. Tonight, Professor Prodi will speak on his vision of Europe. On the conclusion of his talk, we'll take a few questions from the floor. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, I give you Professor Romano Prodi, Prime Minister of Italy, LSE alumnus. Professor Prodi, welcome back. May you always feel welcome in the school.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I give my thanks to Anthony Giddens for his warm invitation. As he told, I was invited twice, but I could come here for the second time. It is always enjoyable to return where I received a major part of my education, and I still cherish a living memory of my studies in the LSE under the direction of Basil Yemi, now Professor Emeritus of Economics. When Professor Giddens asked what topic I should like for my lecture, there was no doubt or hesitation. I shall speak on Europe. I told him on my vision of Europe. To my mind, in fact, Europe means many things. It means a huge market, an enormous competitive environment capable of producing prosperity and technological innovation. It means a model of a society based on individual rights. It means a degree of social cohesion unsurpassed in the history of the world. And it means a great power that can play its role in global affairs. In the last few years, more than anything else, Europe has meant the challenge of the single currency. This is the topic to which I shall first direct my attention turning back to the other topics afterwards. Economic and monetary union with the creation of the euro represent an act of faith in Europe and at the same time a challenge in the broader context of the global economy. This is an event that never happened in world history. Really, it never happened in the world history. It never happened to join together without a war, without a political constriction, so many different currencies and create one currency. The renunciation of the power of coinage is in fact a great political decision. The state is abandoning one of its most traditional instruments of sovereignty. On the threshold of the 21st century, this is more visible even than military sovereignty, the symbolic sword of a nation. However, the euro poses a challenge to the new international economy. With the single currency, the member countries of the European Union will be well equipped to deal with the recurrent turmoils of financial market. In addition, the single currency is the logical triumph of the single market that we have built. Only with a common currency we may in fact get a complete freedom of all productive factors. Only through a common currency we have a common market. Without common currency, we have half a common market. Recent events certainly offer solid grounds for optimism. During the Asian crisis, that is not yet finished, of course, the European currencies fluctuated as a group. On comparable occasions from the past, not too distant past, it was the Deutsche Mark that appreciated against most of other European currencies. This provides yet another confirmation that the path on which we embarked several years back is the right one. It confirms that monetary system we have built for ourselves at the European level works and works well. After years of macroeconomic convergence dictated by the Treaty of Maastricht, a convergence that has performed much better than expected, we are thus now on the eve of major transformation in the collective structure that govern the economic and social life of the countries of Europe. These are not transitory, but on the contrary, these are permanent changes. It is at least since the first oil crisis in the early 70s that the Western countries have been living in a sort of age of uncertainty. The uncertainty was linked to the redistribution of the world resources. New protagonists have entered the global stage. Today, the mechanism of redistribution no longer consists in pushing up raw material prices, which trigger inflation, but through the effort of emerging countries to increase their share in manufacturing markets. Whereas in the 70s, many countries, Italy among them, many have failed to perceive the need to revise the collective behavior and even individual expectation. Today, things are very, very different. Now, the uncertainty of external context is coupled with the realization that economic growth will no longer proceed in a linear trend. What is more, where the old Fordist organization of the economy tended by its very nature to generate greater equality in income distribution, the new system of production based on electronics and information technology tend towards inequality. In other words, they lead to a sharper dichotomy between the literate and the illiterate, between the included and the excluded, insiders and outsiders. We all of us here at this school, recall Ralph Dahrendorf's thesis of the two-third society. These economic and social changes have enormously increased the number of people who are obliged to rely on the benefits of social welfare. This means the excluded. And this means that there is a first compatibility to which our systems of social protection must adapt, that is the macroeconomic consistency, given scarce budget resources, or, to use language more appropriated to this forum, in the context of a fiscal crisis of the state, diminishing these guarantees is the only way to reallocate scarce resources to the support of those who are suffering the most severe economic and social distress. There is also a second, no less important, compatibility. The systems of social protection need to be made consistent with the new types of works and with the new models of social mobility. The European response to the challenge of the Asian capitalist cannot consist in giving up the European model, but in its reform, possibly a very broad reform. Over the years, the different systems of collective welfare have been an important instrument for eradicating class difference, thus developing a mechanism of social integration and a spur to national identity. The success of this system coincided, and not by mere chance, with the Europe's most buoyant period of economic growth. Today, the resumption of economic growth appears to be once again more closely bound up with the ability to navigate the seas of domestic and international competition. But the system efficiency may be reduced by welfare systems that generate distorted incentives. The implicit need to curb the growth of social spending in all the countries of Europe in order to deal with population aging and international competition is heightened by economic convergence and the Stability Pact. Won't such spending curbs undercut the process of national identification? If this were so, then at the end of this process, what kind of Europe would be delivered to us? Social welfare systems are at the intersections of all this problem. The Italian welfare system, in particular, adds its own characteristic anomalies. First, hyperprotection for some groups and some types of risk, and inadequate coverage of other groups and risk. Second, over-channeling of benefit payment through the pension system. For all this reason, for many months now, welfare reforms has been at the top of Italy's political agenda. The convergence plan, drafted by the Italian government and approved by the ECOFIN Council on January 19th, and the 1998 budget law trace a reasonable, practicable route to the design of a new welfare system, the welfare of opportunities. The synergic action between free market, widened competition, and opportunities is the master plan of the new European building. As the 80s gave way to the 90s, political and economic debate was focused on the struggle between two principal models of capitalism, the Anglo-Saxon capitalism and the German capitalism. On the first reading, the essential difference was regarded as being constituted by the financial order, that is, the ways in which enterprises are financed. The central role of the stock market in the Anglo-Saxon countries was contrasted with the preeminence of the German mixed banking model. Closer inspection, however, revealed that this did not exhaust the difference, which also touched more directly economic and social issues, such as the safeguard for citizens in need and the relative abundance of the job opportunities the system offers. For many years, the German model was considered to be economically and socially superior in combining efficiency and equity, economic growth, and social cohesion. Now, a few years later, the rivalry between the two models continues. And as so often in history, the pendulum has swung back in the other way. The United States can boast its excellent economic and financial performance. The world technological leadership, and above all, the creation of millions and millions of jobs, while unemployment in the European Union has risen to simply intolerable levels. Sustained and rapid economic growth combined with global flexibility explain this success. Nevertheless, in treating the economic and social dimension, an additional factor must be considered, namely the greater or lesser inequality of income distribution. When inequality is great, is harmful to growth because it excludes too many people from the economic game and leads to inappropriate economic policy. On this respect, it is the countries of continental Europe with their extensive system of social protection that have achieved better results. Their income distribution is generally, even now, less unequal. To simplify, the distinction between the two types of capitalism can now be seen as the distinction between different systems of social protection. Financial institutions of the two models will be, in fact, less and less distinguishable. Banks and stock exchanges are complementary allocative mechanisms. But this is not the case of public social security and welfare programs, reconciling equity and social cohesion, which are not only moral but also economic values, with labor market flexibility, which means more job opportunities for citizens, remains the hardest task facing Western society at this end of the century. The European model of welfare confronts the American, and the pendulum, as we have seen, swings back and forth. Economic histories provide useful lessons. In any case, we are firmly convinced that macroeconomic stabilization is a basic prerequisite for sustained economic growth. It is from this standpoint that the drastic reduction of inflation achieved by all the members of the European Union, including Italy, must be rated as a great success and a precondition for success in the fight against unemployment. The result of this macroeconomic stabilization is a decline in interest rates, which will benefit the investments of the firms and households. An essential part of any serious policy of economic stabilization is the reduction of the public debt. In many of the European countries, the debt has reached unsustainable levels. Financial adjustment and compliance with the Maastricht criteria is key to setting a limit to the action of governments. They may not pile a boundless burden of debt on future generations. Adjustment was imposed by Maastricht, but at a deeper level, this objective is valuable in its own right because it restores equity between generations. All the member states are engaged in the building of monetary union, regardless of whether or not the individual governments have chosen to participate from the beginning. Monetary unification, however, is only a part of the wider perspective of European integration. I have personally taken part in the negotiation leading to the Treaty of Amsterdam, the decision on EU enlargement and the summit on employment. I am now convinced that it is only at the European level that we can deal successfully with the great challenge confronting our countries. But the European institutions are not yet ready. They need to be strengthened and adapted to the reality of the enlargement. Here, what I mean in particular is the formation of the true European foreign policy, the design of a common policy on immigration and asylum, the creation of a common social space within which to realize economic union. The European Council in Amsterdam took some steps in this direction. Especially encouraging was the insertion of the social protocol into the treaty provisions. The British government took a very constructive attitude and thus contributed to this significant achievement. Common foreign and security policy was also reinforced, although not as much as I hoped. I just mentioned the great step of the enlargement to new member states. A growing Europe is a vital Europe, which, as its founding treaty reads, is open to all the countries of the continent that share its values and intend to pursue its common policies. Now, for the first time, enlargement will take our community beyond that imaginary line that until quite recently we used it to call the Iron Curtain. The symbolic significance of this transition should be a source of pride and a spur to future progress. But an enlarged European Union needs to be equipped with the machinery to make it work. This means taking up where we left off in the last night in the Amsterdam Council. Specifically, I refer to weighted votes in the Council, to significant extension of majority voting, and to a reduction in the number of commissioners. Unless the changes are fully implemented, it will not be possible to ensure the functioning of the Union and achieve the ambitious goal that we have set. This is the reason why Italy, France, and Belgium have jointly stated that a new European institutional reform is needed before the first enlargement takes place. The European leaders who gathered at the summit in Luxembourg in November agreed to enhance the social dimension of the European economic policy. The primary responsibility for labor policy is in the hands of the individual member states. It's up to them, first and foremost, to provide economic agents with an overall environment more propitious to the creation of jobs. But when unemployment is so sweeping in nature and so impervious to sectoral intervention, it becomes clear that the response must be on a broader scale. It was in this awareness that on the eve of the Luxembourg summit, Tony Blair, Goran Persson, and I issued our joint statement, that is, we stated that job creation can be boosted by our ability to foster the competitiveness of enterprise and the employability of the labor force, by enhancing the role of the single market, by removing the barriers to job creation by small and medium-sized enterprises, and by promoting employability and lifelong learning. The European Union can make a key contribution by proper regulatory incentives and by directing the community funds towards those projects that can create new employment. Should Europe prove unable to respond positively to the legitimate demand for this job on the part of too many unemployed citizens, it would lose the consensus upon which our joint adventure is founded. Strengthening European institutions, enlarging the community to embrace new members, creating new employment, all these objectives lie within our reach. And they complete the design of the single currency, helping to increase the efficiency and the competitiveness of the new Europe. But we have to be clear. To compete in the global arena, Europe must regain the leadership that has been its pride through centuries of history, productive and technological leadership, intellectual and cultural leadership. We must close the gap that has been opened in the recent years by the transfer to other parts of the world of the most modern research and development centers, which are the fulcrum of the modern way of production. Here, too, we must be aware that the enormous financial resources and facilities needed for investment in research require dimension such as to take advantage of economic of scales. They require continental dimensions. We must focus our efforts on making the most of what immense patrimony of knowledge and culture that is the distinctive feature of what we call Europe. I am thinking in particular of the capacity to bring back to our schools and university the world's best minds. The young people who converged on the University of Medieval Europe from the known corners of the earth accumulated and then dispensed the knowledge of the past and laid the basis of the modern world. The challenge we must face is to translate this heritage into a new opportunity for growth and development. And here yet again, it is Europe that formed the perspective within which our commitment to the future must unfold. EMU will change the equilibrium in the international monetary system. The creation of a Europe will entail revolutionary change, as it will emerge as a potential new global reserve currency on a par with the dollar. This in turn will generate a more complex international monetary system, no longer based on a single currency, but also a more stable one, as financial arrangements will no longer be influenced by the domestic process of merely one economy, but will more safely rely on a more varied selection of strong currency. I therefore believe that the euro will create opportunities and will have a beneficial impact on the world economy, even if it will require careful consultation and diplomacy. As has already happened in the trade field, Europe will therefore have to assume increasing responsibilities in the monetary area. In quantitative terms, enlargement to the countries of East Central Europe could widen the area of the Union about one-third, whereas its population will increase by 29%, even if the GNP will increase by less than 10%. You understand how important it is for peace and political reasons, the enlargement to East, but how difficult it is and how economic consequences bring. I repeat, one-third of population, one-third of area, 29% of population, and less than 10% of GNP. The accession of these countries would dramatically alter the political map of Europe, as we have known it over the last five decades, and it would put the seal on the reunification of the two sides of Europe, began with the crumbling of the Iron Curtain in 1989. Enlargement will eventually produce a larger and more confident Europe, which will have a greater stake in the maintenance of stable global relations. It will also raise the profile of the Union's strategic role, as the European Union will come into greater contact with other geopolitical areas to the east and to the southeast. Europe will therefore become increasingly responsible and will have to develop a truly global vision. This is especially true in relation with the two great areas of the Middle East, where our most important security interests lay, and of East Asia, which is rapidly becoming one of our most important economic partners. This does not mean that we should follow Professor Huntington's theory about an infant clash of civilization and the insignificant need to prepare for a conflict between different cultures. I think that we have to be prepared to harmonize and to make living together these two cultures. The big problem for Europe in the next century will be certainly the relation between what we call the Christianity and the Islamic world. I think that this will be the real challenge, and this challenge cannot be solved in a military way or only through the strength, but must be challenged preparing institutions, preparing compromises, preparing a way in which we can live together. And the relations with these regions are much more complex and require careful and skillful diplomacy and not simple generalization. We must therefore resist the temptation to erect great walls between Europe and the rest of the world, because this could be short-sighted and dangerously destabilizing. We should therefore act as honest broker in a regional dispute, expand our foreign economic policy to engage these important areas, as well as seize the opportunities of socializing important countries, such, for example, China and Iran, into the great community of nations. Europe has in fact emerged from bitter rivalries by realizing that its interest lay in the development of a strong and prosperous global economy rather than in the pursuit of national hegemony. We must help other countries to realize that isolation and self-assertiveness are counterproductive, and that the true stakes of the great nations are in political and economic development rather than in hegemony. Local actors are often too absorbed in contingent and historical problems to realize this basic truth, and the role of an important outside actor could, in this light, be essential. This is why I believe that Europe will play an increasingly significant role on the world stage, even if, till now, the common foreign security policy has not yet really started. The future of Europe will not only be relevant for its own citizens and firms, but also for the wider world. Ever since the Treaty of Rome, Europe has had an indirect impact on global international politics as a model of integration for other parts of the world. The spectacular composition of age-old disputes that between France and Germany, as well as between Romania and Hungary, has in fact represented a hope for other, a hope and an example for other regional conflict. The objective of pacification of the old continent, which was at the heart of founding father of Europe, has been by now successfully accomplished. It is now time for a new era in which Europe will take more direct responsibility in the management of international relations. When I last came to the LSE exactly 2 years ago, I began my presentation by asserting that despite all the uncertainty which surrounded Europe at the time, Europe is one of the great success stories of our time. I think that the last few months, which have seen the convergence toward EMU and the beginning of the process of enlargement, reconfirm my views. In spite of difficulties and obstacles, we are building a larger and more integrated Europe, which will be a leading player in the new world policy. Thank you.
We've now got some space for questions. Can I ask anyone who's going to pose a question to wait until the microphone reaches them? Could we see who would like to ask a question to start off? There's a microphone coming just around to you.
To ask, do you not think that the effort to relaunch economic growth in Europe and through the drive towards monetary union will necessarily reduce the amount of social welfare that the union as a whole and the countries individually can apply?
No, I don't think that will necessarily reduce the welfare area. What I mean is that this area has been reduced by the global competition, not by the creation of EMU or the European area. Without a European area, it would be more and more reduced. And as a matter of fact, I think from this point of view, Europe has something to say to the European experience. Is maybe very useful if we compare it to the American, to the Asian experience. We are reducing welfare much, much less than the other big world entities. We are reducing welfare, but we are concentrating it, at least in my case, on the people really in need. And so we are reducing welfare in the sense that we are reducing the part of welfare that is not strictly necessary for helping real people in need. And this was a necessary step that we had to do and we have to do in any case. But I have in my mind the idea that after the big problem. You know, now we are, everybody of us is only thinking to currency, to rate of exchange, this stuff, you know. But when the process will be settled down in next May, I think that we shall perceive that in the old European tradition we have a set of values in how we organize it, our society, in which there are a lot of underlying structure in our society that will be very helpful to the old world. I think that we shall be obliged to find a compromise or a mediation to express better my concept, between the necessity of welfare and solidarity and the necessity of world competition. And we can do it only on a continental basis. And continental Europe has such a fantastic experience, a many centuries experience, you know, that if we analyze it deeply, I think we shall get out much better than any other part of the world. This is my belief. But we have to be very honest and very clear, and to understand what we have to give up and what we have to enforce. And we must understand that we have to give all our resources to people in need and to develop new potential and not to protect the old habits. This is our task.
My name is Giulio Flore, and I'm a former alumni of the London School of Economics. You have stressed quite a few times the necessity to reform the welfare state. Have you any idea about the direction of reform? Have you in your mind any model which is currently applied in Europe? Thanks.
There is no one dominating model, but there is a great experience that we may utilize. That is what I call the great experience that we received from, the social experience of the last century in many countries of continental Europe. But we have to be very selective in two main directions. First, labor protection, labor mobility. You know, and the Dutch experience in the last year may be very useful. Very, very useful. Second, as I told before, we have to protect only the real people in need, and we have to help the potential of the young generation. I think that this means that, in my strategy, in my response to this challenge is to put all the resources that I can collect to education, to have a limiting welfare, to be very selective, and to make a big effort on the promotion of the young generation. Otherwise, there will be no resources for having, you know, a welfare state going to the future generation. You know, the real equilibrium are not possible to get. In the Italian experience, but this is only Italian experience, is almost impossible to get this through without a combined action between trade unions, employers, and government. You know, we have done sensible change in the last years, not enough to have a long term equilibrium, but at least to have an equilibrium for the next 10 years. And even if we started from a situation that was probably worse from the point of view of the pension scheme, worse than other European countries, we did a lot of change that no other country has done, only because we did with agreement. And I don't think that you can impose in this such a difficult matters any violent change without this type of agreements, you know. And I am convinced that people now understand more and more what is needed and what is not needed, and that we can get the result that was that were impossible to achieve years before. Of course, you have to go step by step. Sometimes there are a lot of complaints because the results are not enough, because you don't make a revolution but only change. But for example, in the last reforms, we got in a country in which we have many contradictions, because we have the highest share of GNP for pension than in any other European country, but one of the lowest share of the total social expenditure, you know. So we have a lot of contradiction, because we have to, you know, to correct the pensions, but you have also to think that you may be pushed to spend more on other sectors, like, let's say, unemployment benefits, or this, that, almost in existence. You know, in this step, we stopped the increase of the pension expenditure at least for 12 years. Then, you know, in 12 years' time, you may make another correction. But this has, you know, make available a quantity of resources that will be enough to have long-lasting equilibrium. And I think that the next step will be the necessity of harmonizing among all the European countries this decision. Remember that all of us, I don't know if, you know, just because we didn't want to afford the problem, all of us will underestimate the consequence also in the welfare reform of the monetary union. Is completely unthinkable. Then we have one currency only. You don't harmonize your broad fiscal policy, especially concerning the cost of labor. You know, you don't harmonize your main issues of welfare policy. We are obliged to do it. And this is why I think that we have to meditate, to study, and to rethink all our European tradition and try to find a common way out of the problem. But if we don't do this, the monetary union will be difficult and unstable. And because I think that when we have signed the monetary union, we will have a big interest to stick on it and to strengthen it, I think that the harmonization of welfare state will be a necessity.
Would you like to pick the next?
Yes. It's probably easier for you. You have the clock and you have the power, you know. It's,
it's a bit hard to see in the lights near the
fire. Microphone here. I hope that my vision of Europe is more clear than the vision of the theatre. That's because I
could I ask Professor Prodi if he has any concerns over the single currency and over the erosion of the ability of the Italian government to manage its own affairs.
To manage it?
The ability of the Italian government to manage its own affairs, whether your actual ability to operate independently will be affected, and to what degree, by a single currency. The director, in his initial remarks, referred to the difficulties over the Italian budget last autumn, I do wonder if that might be a symptom of the sort of constraints that a single currency might apply on the ability of the Italian government. I mean, was that, for example, a consequence of obtaining convergence, which was necessary to enter the single currency, and will the necessity to continue convergence continue to have an effect on the way in which you in Italy manage your own internal affairs?
Look, I am accustomed to be under examination, you know. This is my job since I have taken the government. I don't know if I am a prime minister or a student, you know, sometimes. But because in my life, I for the main part of my life, I've been a professor, is a big humiliation for me. But anyway, look, I thought when I came to the government, I should be into the first group. Nobody believed it. Nobody trusted. Now 90% of the people trust it. This is not because I convinced them, but because I did a policy that was coherent, serious, and at least long-lasting. Let's say today is 20 months that I am in government, and I never had any change of my policy. Of course, you may trust or not that in the future will be done in this way, but the same observation can be done to any other country. And I tell you that the Italian people have never been hidden of what the government wanted to do. I even called a tax European tax to demonstrate what means Europe, you know. And I have been criticized, telling, you know, you start Europe with a tax. I say, look, people must understand. And the approval rate of the government has increased day by day. Not because I have been, you know, lax, but because I have been coherent. And I tell you that this is the only way in which I can fight inflation, I can fight unemployment, and I may have good results. And probably, well, I'm sorry to say that, but probably because of the continuous change of government, because of, you know, because of history, the real analysis concerning Italy is not proper, it's not exact, you know. There is a habit to compare debt and GNP, but nobody compares the rate of saving. That is an enormous rate of saving, you know, and that the debt is all an internal debt, and there is no virtually foreign debt in Italy. That all the balance of payment, trade balance, is coherent and consistent, and so all the macroeconomic variables are in good order. So I don't think why I must be always examined if I shall behave well in the future, you know. I think that there are the same odds that other countries behave well and don't behave well. But I tell you that Italians have understood what is better and what is worse. And when you tell, or somebody asked me, that I am also proved by a party that is called Rifondazione Comunista, and I need a vote, I can tell you, can you believe that Rifondazione Comunista has voted all my budget restriction, all my decision, without any hesitation? You know, they follow this because the country is united on the European goal, and there is no other country in Europe that he is so determined to understand that his future is linked with Europe. And I think that the potential of my country are great, you know. I don't want to be impolite to remember that the personal GMP, Italian GMP, is higher than the British one. And so I think, you know, even with the Mezzogiorno and anything else, you know, why? I'm convinced, I am very sincere, I am convinced that it's the only explanation that the country, so poor after the war, with 51% of people employed in agriculture, like all the poorest country now, we are emerging in such a way only because we entered before the UK in the common market. This is my vision, you know, this is the reason. And this is why, when I explain to my people, look, your progress is linked to Europe, they say, yes, I agree, I agree. And they made the sacrifice. I don't think that the same is maybe applied to UK. I am not a teacher, as I told you, I am a student. But I think that for my county, this works. And will work in the future. And the future, I do understand that if we are linked to Europe, we shall show to our European partners that we can be even leaders in Europe. This is my opinion.
I think we've got time for one more question, but we must finish sharp at 6 o'clock. There's someone at least towards the back.
Thank you very much. Could I ask Professor Prodi two questions?
Can you speak louder, you know?
So can I ask Professor Prodi two questions, please?
Yes.
One, you talked about Christianity and Islam. Do you favour Turkey becoming eventually a member of the European Union? Secondly, could I ask, the monetary union creates a huge new challenge for the labour markets of all European countries. Could I ask if you think that the Italian labour market is sufficiently flexible to deal with any shocks that may encounter in monetary union without devaluation, including the south of Italy, and whether they have any concerns, whether the negotiations for the 35-hour working week could interfere with the flexibility of the labour market in Italy?
Yeah. First question, Turkey. I thank you because this, you know, is a question that goes on one of my main points. You know, we are Italy, but Europe too, but Italy is just in the border between the Christianity, as I call it, and the Islamic world. And I think that we must not only live in peace, but cooperate together. I think that the clash of civilization will be the worst outcome of the world. And this is why I've always operated in building good and constructive relation with Turkey. With Mrs. Siller before, with the Yilmaz today, I had many long conversations telling them, look, we must give the example of living together and joining our effort together. Of course, this in the end must be that you are part of the European Union, you know. Of course, Italy is particularly interested because we are in the southeast flank of Europe, and so, you know, we are much more interested than you to this problem, but I think this is a general problem. Of course, there are two obstacles. I have been always very clear. One is free circulation of manpower. If you want to have this now, immediately, it can't be done. You know, practically, it cannot be done. Second is regional aid. If we apply to Turkey this rule, you will get 95% of all aids. You know, so it's practically. But provided that we discuss these two issues, I think that, you know, we can start the discussion of the participation of Turkey to the European Union. And both the government and Turkey, they agreed that this was a sound, you know, practical starting of our conversation. But then the decision of the European Union was not to start it. I think, and I expressed myself clearly, that was a mistake. And, you know, and the same night in which we decided not to start the conversation, Yılmaz called me and he told, look, Prodi, you told before that the relation between the Islamic world and the Christianity will be the biggest issues of, and I said, and you start with this decision. I said, look, it's not my fault, you know. But anyway, I think that this was a mistake. I think that provided that the 2 points I listed must be solved in a different way, we have to start again our conversation with Turkey, because this will be a main issue of the peaceful coexistence for the future and of the creation of a real wide European area. This is what I think, you know. Then you may have an area of monetary union inside this bigger area. You know, I don't want to get into the technical problem, but the problem of Turkey is of vital importance to avoid the clash of civilization. This is what I think. Second, we need to have more flexibility of labor. We did a lot on this point, really, much more than I thought. But for the Italian case, the problem is very simple. We have practically no unemployment in North Italy and a terrible high unemployment in South Italy. The average is 12%, but we go from 2.5%, that is over full employment, to 28%, you know. So it's different from any other. So mobility is much more important, but I don't teach sociology, and you know, I cannot explain, but people are not mobile at any condition, you know. There is only in the very top of the society, or in the very bottom of the society, you migrate, in Italy at least, you know. So people stay unemployed in south, and then don't go north to work, generally. Now I'm doing a lot of effort joining Northern Industrialist and Trade Association and trade unions to move completely to the south with a lot of incentives in the weakest areas of the south. This is the policy I'm now building. This is permitted by the European Union rules, and this will be my future policy, because it will be more and more necessary, because the future growth of Italy will be based more on export than on internal demand. And of course, there is virtually no export from the southern regions, by definition, because they have no companies, no diffused industries. And so I have to move companies from north to south in a joint effort. And we created special areas in the south with special incentives from fiscal and labor. And in this, the labor regulation are much more favorable than in the north of Italy. There is a lot of difference. And I think that we shall have results using these market rules. The problem of 35 hours, of course, now is not a problem of economy, it's a problem of theology, you know. And so you should need a priest to explain it. If we want to stick on the problem, when I signed the agreement, it was clear and is recognized by both the signer that it is, provided that it doesn't change the development of the economy, the regional equilibrium and the sectorial equilibrium of the companies, you know. So we are discussing on this basis and not on theological basis. And I'm confident, and I tell you also because we are going on daily deepening of the problem, I am confident that we may find a solution that will be helpful for job creation and will not harm the economy. Of course, we need to be empirical, we need to follow the agreement that we signed, and we need the type of social cohesion that I explained before. This is a sort of agreement that without this cohesion between trade unions, government and employer association, without an agreement, this type of agreement will be very harmful to the country. But we are working in this direction, and I think that will give a positive flexibility to the system and an incentive to mobility and change that is important. It was not, of course, my first choice in my agenda. It's very clear. I have always been honest on that, you know. But I think that is a problem that can be positively solved with the cooperation between the social forces, you know. And I am confident that in a few days we may have a scheme of solution, you know. This is what I think, you know.
There, I'm afraid we have to finish. Can I ask everyone to stay in their seats until Professor Prodi has left the stage? Can I thank Professor Prodi for coming to speak here tonight and for his powerful lecture? Can I say how pleased I am that he made it on the second attempt? And we'd love you to come back again. Thanks very, very much.